Evening. Let's turn on over to Hebrews chapter 8. I don't know if I did that. Did I do the Hebreos capítulo 8? Oh, man, I must have missed it. we're chapter 8, Hebrews chapter 8. We kind of already started it, but this is like the real start, so we're on track. So, we're actually going to start. Let's read verses 1 through 6, and then we'll pick up from there. Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 6. Now, the main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, so it is necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. Now, if you were on earth, you would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle. For, see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. All right, perfect. So we're going to hopefully get through all of these six verses tonight. Remember, last week we did a lot of just review type stuff, and the review was to remind us lots of what we've already covered. Kind of, he's been building up to this point in Hebrews, right? So if you're going to preach or you're going to teach something, you don't just start where, you can kind of throw where you want to go in the beginning, kind of like the topic statement or the thesis, right? But you don't want to just go straight into all that and just be like, here you go, take it, and there I'll see you later, right? He's just slowly been building this case, and now he gets to the point. He says, now the main point. You guys are ready. Here it is. And this is really going to be, he's been gaining a lot of momentum talking about the priesthood. He's been talking about the priesthood a lot, and he really actually hasn't brought in this other element that we're going to see in chapter 8. He's been talking about priesthood. You've seen a lot of stuff we've been building up to at this point. He's going to make a subtle shift into a different topic tonight. Okay? And this is really, really going to be exciting because this is where it also includes us. We understand the priesthood. We understand Jesus is our high priest. We get that. We've been going over that, right? But there's going to be this transition a little bit, and you're going to see by the end in verse 6. And that's really going to be pretty exciting because next week we'll probably have some fun stuff to say on that as well. But today I have some stuff for you. So Hebrews chapter 8, let's just do a little bit of recap on verse 1. So now the main point of what has been said is this. The best thing that could ever happen, we talked about, is not Trump winning the election. It is that Jesus is our high priest. That's the best thing that could ever happen. And yes, it would be nice if the economy goes up and does well for a while, whatever. Those things are also nice. But at the end of the day, let's keep the main thing the main thing. And that's Jesus. He is our high priest. He already has authority. He is also making offering, and he offered on our behalf. And this is what he's saying here. Jesus, high priest, who has taken a seat at the right hand of the throne and the majesty in the heavens, he reigns. He is a minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. Now, something I'm going to do this on the board. I did this last week, but I'm going to do it again. This week, we're not going to talk about the tabernacle in depth tonight, okay? So don't get too excited. I don't even know if I'm going to do it. Hopefully I don't just mess this all up. But and yes, there's the bed and the pillow. Okay, the bread. Okay, this is tabernacle, holy place, right? And then the holy of holies. Lampstand. And then altar of incense. The cherubim, mercy seat. We're going to talk about that more soon. But, in verse 2, he does say something, and this is going to come up a few times. He says, a minister in the sanctuary. Now, minister, where does your mind go when you hear minister? You think of priest, right? A minister, a servant, somebody who's doing service. That's what this word is going to be related to. He is a minister. He's ministering. He's doing a priestly type thing. He's ministering in the sanctuary. Now, remember, he is acting as, and more specifically, the book of Hebrews is really going to narrow in on the high priest, right? He's not just saying Jesus is a priest. Jesus is the high priest, right? There's going to be some really significant things to Jesus being the high priest. We'll see some of this as it develops throughout the book of Hebrews. Jesus is the high priest. Now what, and you guys already probably are way ahead of me on this, what is very specific to the high priest? What can he do that none of the other priests could ever do? Which is very, very important. Yeah, he actually gets to go into the back room, right? So we have the holy place, right? The whole thing is meant to be holy and set apart. But there's a place even further back that has a veil separating it, and this is the Holy of Holies, right? And we understand terminology like that, right? Because these are both holies, but this is the Holy of Holies. We know there's many lords on the earth, right? Many kings on earth. But Jesus is Lord of Lords. He is Lord above all. He is King of Kings, right? This is the Holy of Holies. This is the holiest place. And why would this be the holiest place on earth? Dave?
Because that's where God resides. That's where he settles down into.
Yeah, this would be where he communicates that I dwell there, right? The presence of God would be dwelling here, the mercy seat. I guess I'm already jumping ahead to talk about the tabernacle. We see here it says sanctuary. Now, it's been a while since I've picked on other religions too much. I guess tonight I get to a little bit, and it's not because I just genuinely like doing it, but it's probably worth mentioning a little bit. Sanctuary is misused a lot in our day and age, in the religious world, right? How many of you have seen sanctuary used out of context? At least once or twice. How many of you maybe even used it out of context, right? I've seen places, and I've been to places, I've even worked at places where they say, can you do some work, or we're going to meet in the sanctuary, right? Now, where does your mind go? What do you think of when you think of sanctuary in that context? This is where we go to worship God, right? This would be our sanctuary right here. The main assembly area is how most people would view it. That's not biblically accurate, though, right? We understand that. We understand this is just a building. There's nothing more holy about this place than if we were to meet under a tree, right? There is a, and I have to be careful because I don't want to pick on people too much, but even within the restoration movement, I've heard this even in our own town, in the Church of Christ, not this building, but the other Church of Christ in town, right? And there's a lot of people who are trying to make good movements in different ways. Lots of them might be misguided, right? One of the things that was really interesting is I was studying with a guy, and he basically came around, and he was like, wow, we started studying worship and service. And he said, this is really cool. I really like a lot of the stuff that you're bringing to the table. And he said it really dawned on him whenever he saw this kid running around like in an assembly room like here, right? Their main assembly area. He saw this kid running around, and one of the older gals, she told the kid needs to stop running around. And the reason she gave was because he shouldn't be running in the sanctuary or the holy place, basically. Now, with him, we had been studying through this for a little while, and that really clicked with him. Because I was telling him things, people are misguided, like they're being deceived, essentially. They don't have a clear understanding of worship and service. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, it's really hard to pinpoint that until you just see it. And he saw it. He's like, whoa, why is this lady saying the kid can run out there, but he can't run in here? But she was kind of communicating to the kid that this is where we worship. You can't run in here. Now, I'm not saying you should just let your kids run around. I guess that's between you and your kids. I don't know what rules we wanted to make on that or whatever. I don't really care personally. I'll stay out of it until my kid gets to that age. But the sanctuary, there's no argument you could ever make that kids shouldn't run in here because it's more holy than another spot, I guess, is what I'm going at. And, the sanctuary, I've heard that in a lot of places. The problem is it doesn't just stop at those places, is it can sometimes bleed even into restoration movement as well. And that's why understanding worship and service is so important. It's not just something that people come up and they're like, you know, this is all semantics. This is all about words, you know, and you just need to appreciate this and that about the Bible, and this is just higher learning, this and that. No, a lot of it is actually very real, and it becomes very applicable even in that scenario. Somebody in the church tells a kid to stop running because their perspective is that one place is more holy than another, because it's all mixed up, right? So we understand that one place is not more important than another physically. Obviously, where the Christian is, this is going to be up here, right? Where we are is where the most holy place is, because we are the tabernacle of God, right? We are the temple of God. The New Testament teaches that a lot. But Jesus is a minister in the sanctuary. The communication here is not just a holy place. It is even beyond the veil into the very presence of God, being the high priest. Now, I've kind of gone back and forth how in depth I wanted to go on this. If you want to look into it more in your own time, you can. Just know that the word there for sanctuary is plural. Just a side note, okay? In the modern literal version, it actually says, and they took liberty to say this, but they say he's a minister in the Holy of Holies. And that seems to flow really well, because remember, the Holy of Holies is where God's presence is, right? So it makes sense. Jesus being the high priest, he goes into the presence of God on our behalf. He goes into the Holy of Holies, the most holy of all holy places. And I just figured I'd bring that up a little bit here. And it goes on and he says, in the true tabernacle. So I think we mentioned this last week. What does tabernacle mean? And the key is actually kind of right there in the verse. Our bodies are a tabernacle of some sort, right? It just means a tent. Tabernacle means a tent. Now, something that's really interesting about the book of Hebrews, I've learned this as I've got to study this out. And I was thinking about, even in Jesus' time, they had a temple, right? They didn't have the tabernacle set up like Moses. They had a temple, and I guess Herod tried to do something nice to it or something. And then, remember, Solomon made a temple for God. He made a house for God. The glory of that place was very great, was it not? It was a very, very nice building. I remember when I was a teenager in Texas, my dad and I got to go to the Dallas Cowboys new stadium when they, not long after they had built it. You know, the dome, they had this huge TV. It was like the first of its kind. It was so nice. It was really cool and exciting, right? And I believe the whole thing was over $1 billion for the construction, everything. They did a lot. And I just remember how exciting that was. That was very exciting. It was cool. And then we even got to go to a preseason game. I believe they got to play the Oakland Raiders. And it was exciting. Solomon's temple was worth a lot more. It was way more exciting. They even had gold in there. I mean, I didn't go to the Cowboys Stadium and just see walls with gold on them. Solomon's temple is way better. Now, this is what's interesting about Hebrews, is that we understand the temple, Solomon's temple had lots of glory, right? So it had so much glory that when they tried to rebuild the temple after the captivity, what was the reaction of the old priests and Levites who saw the original glory of Solomon's temple? They saw the new one that got rebuilt, and they started weeping, right? They were like, this thing is nothing in comparison to the old temple, Solomon's temple. Okay, the temple, Solomon's temple had lots of glory. It was it was luxurious. There's lots of money surrounding it as well. But the writer of Hebrews, interestingly enough, does not really mention the temple a lot. He keeps on referencing tabernacle, tabernacle, tabernacle. And again, this may not, maybe it doesn't really matter to you a ton, but I just think that you should know this. The tabernacle is really where he's pointing back more towards, and this is because it's in relation with the covenant and with Moses and with the pattern. Again, it's not as glory, it's not as gold and all this money, as much money. It still was nice. There's still lots of nice things in gold. There's still things that are put into it, but it wasn't anything like we would think the temple, like billions of dollars worth, right? The tabernacle is the illustration, it is the picture that the writer of Hebrews decides to put in the mind of the listener or the reader. He goes back and he says, the tabernacle, the tabernacle. Matter of fact, he actually mentions it several times. Let's just jump ahead a little bit. We're going to go to chapter 1 and start in verse 1, chapter 9, verse 1 through 3. Now, even the first covenant had regulations of divine service and the earthly sanctuary, for there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which were the lampstand, the table, the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which a golden jar holding the manna, Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. Then he goes on and he says other stuff. What's being referenced here? Tabernacle. We're going to get to this. We're going to talk about tabernacle later. We're going to get to it. But he mentions tabernacle here. And then you get to see it in verse 8. He mentions it in verse 11. He does. Let's read verse 11. But when Christ appeared as high priest of good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not this creation. So what is he communicating about the tabernacle here? It's going to be actually really tie well with chapter 8. It's spiritual, right? It's a spiritual one. It's not made of this creation. It's spiritual. This is perfect with chapter 8. And then let's just look at verse 21. In the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. He's going back even to Moses' time. So, the writer of Hebrews is going back to Moses and that tabernacle. Just wanted to point this out. And this is further illustrated when he says in chapter 8, verse 2, he says, Jesus ministered in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. He's contrasting a physical tent, which would be like the Israelites had in the wilderness, and a spiritual tent that God has pitched, heaven, a heavenly one. Is that pretty clear? Hopefully I'm not losing in too many people. So let's go on to verse 3, because verse 2, he does mention this is a spiritual. Hopefully you're getting the picture now. This is spiritual. Okay, we have a high priest. He's a spiritual high priest, and we have a tabernacle that's not a physical one. It's a spiritual one. It's one that God put up himself. So verse 3, for every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, So it is necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. And we understand that Jesus also has an offering as well. He talks about this later in Hebrews as well. Jesus doesn't offer the things that the physical high priest did, the Levitical ones. His offering was the best, right? And we'll get to that as well. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all. Since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. Now, why is the writer of Hebrews, in verse 4, why is he now mentioning that if Jesus were on earth, he would not be a priest at all? He's further driving a point home. Dave, did you have a comment? Yes. Yeah. So if Jesus, physically, he could never be a priest because he was of the tribe of Judah. He was not a Levite, which we saw that in chapter 7 as well, right? And why is he even mentioning this at all right here? Why is he mentioning that Jesus wasn't a priest on earth? Yeah, okay, he's linking his priesthood to the kingdom of heaven, right? Yeah, all of this, the reason why he's mentioning it here is because he's just driving the point home, this is all spiritual. This is all spiritual. I mean, if Jesus were on earth, would he be a priest? And they'd have to answer him, well, no. But is Jesus a priest? So I'll ask you guys this. If Jesus were on earth, by physical right, would he be a priest? Physically, no. He would not be a priest. But is Jesus a priest? Yes. So, he can't be one by physical means. He is one by spiritual. That's what he's driving in their head. And he's also gone into not a physical tabernacle. He's gone into a spiritual tabernacle. Brad, do you have a comment? Here, let me, is this, I'll grab you real quick. This might be a long comment. Here, I got you.
What's neat about it is we're all priests and by spiritual method, so.
Yeah.
Which is cool, which is really cool. We serve the high priest being priests.
Excellent point, yeah. We are priests. Any other comments that anybody would like to throw in at this?
Yeah, did you have any more comments on the writer of Hebrews' usage of the sacred tent versus the temple? Well, good job showing that the comparison has been to the giving of the law through Moses, so that would have been also the construction of the tabernacle versus a temple that's built, you know, many years later. But the other part that I also think is really cool is you have both done according to the same pattern, right? But, you know, in the Old Testament, the sacred tent could be picked up and moved. And they knew it when it was time to move, when God was on the move. And so it's this really cool picture that we are, you know, considered these sacred tents because we're on the move. And where we go, God goes, right? We're not these foundation, you know, buildings with foundations, and we just, you know, okay, all right, I'm a Christian, and now I'm going to stay right here, you know? I mean, we're to go into the world and make disciples, but it's more of that Christ is with us as we go, and I like that picture from Hebrews as well.
Yeah, it's a great picture.
One of the things that I think is interesting, too, is I was thinking that along the same lines of what Nolan was talking about, but you know, Jesus wasn't ever going to be a priest according to an inferior law. Yeah. He was always a priest according to the order of Melchizedek, which came before the law, which was superior to the law. And that's the whole point that the writer of Hebrews has been working on. So I just think it flows together well with what Mr. Tool was saying.
Yeah, excellent point. He was the king too, right? But he wasn't physically any of those things. So they obviously, as you brought up, the point, which is a great point, that it would It would kind of be meaningless for him to go to an inferior system and serve under that anyways, right? Yeah, good points. And then back to Nolan's comment of we go where God takes us, you know, we kind of follow, and that's the method. When God had gone up, then they would realize, oh, time to get on the move, and then the Levites would tear the whole thing down, and they would start moving around. So this is actually really, it's just good to see what he was using. He goes back to the tabernacle. This is very closely, the tabernacle itself, rather than the temple, was very closely related with Moses and the covenant and the law. Much closer related than the temple. The temple was kind of like came afterwards, right? The tabernacle was, I mean, God laid it all very clearly up. And this is what he's actually going to reference to something we're going to take a look at in the Old Testament here in a second. Yeah, if Jesus were on earth, he would not be a priest at all. Verse 4, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, so we understand there are those who act as priests physically. And at this time, they could look and they could say, oh yeah, I know what a priest is. I look over and see them, right? They have the little white patch and the black shirt, you know. I was kidding. They knew what a priest was. They saw it, they got it, but they knew that Jesus was not a priest by that means. He was not physically a priest. He was not a physical priest, because then if he were, then he would have to be of the Levitical priesthood, and that wasn't going to work. So, as Jared mentioned, though, it's okay that he was not a priest by the order of Aaron. The reason why is because he was a priest by a higher order. So being a priest by the order of Aaron would be a very big pay cut. It would be a very big downgrade. We looked at that in depth in chapter 7, right? You guys got the picture from chapter 7. The priesthood of Melchizedek is way far superior to the priesthood by the order of Aaron. Now, he goes on in verse 5. He talks about those who serve under the old covenant, they serve as a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. I want to kind of break down these two things here tonight, because a lot of this you guys already know, but hopefully I can make it a little bit interactive, at least with my fun little kid stories. The word there for copy is very clearly illustrated by the Old Testament quotation he's going to make. So if you go down to verse 5 in the latter part, he says, see, this is the quotation from the Old Testament. I believe this is Exodus 25. He says, see that you make all things, he's telling Moses, God's telling Moses, see that you make all things according to the copy which was shown to you on the mountain. This is the copy. So if you've ever copied and pasted something, you kind of get this idea. It needs to be just like this. Except when you copy this, make sure when you paste it over here that you blow it up times 100, right? Make it way bigger and more glorious. Obviously, that's not even a great representation because the old is so inferior to the new. But the word that he uses, the word that's used in Exodus 25 is the same word, essentially. It's pretty much the same word. Obviously, it's not the same language, but it's pretty much the same word. It's pattern and copy. That's why he's also going to use this quotation. Now, my little kid example is that when I don't know how this happened, but when I was a little kid, I had Hot Wheels, a lot of them. And I know how that happened. People gave them to me. And I decided that I just really liked the Ferrari. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I thought I was Italian because my name or something. I love the Ferrari. I'm not Italian, by the way. Lots of people get that confused, Lorenzo, Italian, but I'm not. So anyways, I would play with this Ferrari over and over again. And I played with lots of them. And then my sisters and I, we decided to get these big poster boards. And actually, it's probably more my idea than it was theirs. And I always had these big schemes for them. Like at times we would put together entire villages with like Legos and different things. And then I'd have bank accounts and everything, and I would keep track of all their transactions. And they were my Legos, so obviously I get the most of the wealth. And I would keep track of everything, if they're paying their gas, taxes, all of these things. You know, I was a great big brother because I let them use some of my toys as I was able to manipulate them and get all as much money out of them as I could. So I started playing with these a lot, and then we had those big poster boards, and we set those up where we would drive around, and there'd be Walmarts and different things, and we'd have a bunch of cars and make parking lots. It was lots of fun. But that Ferrari in itself really means nothing. It really means nothing, period, other than the idea of what it represents in the real world. Right? That little Ferrari really is, I mean, it's fun for a kid to play with, right? And actually, side note, in Galatians, the law, those who are under the law in the Old Testament, they are likened to children, are they not? Because they're playing with the copy. They're like little children playing with the copy. These who serve under the Old Covenant, guess what? They're just serving under the copy. It's like they're just playing with the Hot Wheels on this little map. This is not the reality. This is not the thing that is yet to come, though. And when I'm playing with that little Ferrari, that's very exciting, but it means nothing. Again, it means absolutely nothing compared to a real Ferrari. Now, as many of you would like to probably see, if I could actually just go get a real Ferrari, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, I probably won't ever have a real Ferrari. Even if I could afford one, it wouldn't ever really be worth it. So I don't think it's even worth entertaining that idea. But it would be fun probably to go race around on one sometime. Birthday gift ideas or Christmas gift ideas. But the little thing means nothing compared to the big thing, right? The real thing is the Ferrari. The real thing in this context, I'm just using this as an example, the real thing is the new covenant. That's the real thing. The little Hot Wheel has no value at all compared to the real thing. And that's the old covenant in 2 Corinthians 3 that talks about this, right? The old law basically had no glory compared to the new one. There was no glory. There's no comparison between a Ferrari and a Hot Wheel. There's not any comparison at all. Not at all. There's no comparison really between the old and the new. And it's actually even a bigger gap. There's a bigger gap between the old and new than even a Hot Wheel and a Ferrari. That's the thing, is that God's new covenant is so much better. And so he uses the term copy, because if I'm playing with that Ferrari, what I've noticed about those things is that they're very intricate, though. They have lots of detail. There's lots of work. They even go to the point of making the dimensions, like, maybe even accurate. Wow, the dimensions are accurate on this little thing that's this big. It's a copy, but it has no glory. The old law is meant to be a copy. These things, we see the tabernacle, we see the priesthood, we see lots of these things. He even says how to put together the tabernacle. Make sure that you see to the copy which I told you. So at some point, Moses is hearing this and he's thinking, okay, I need to put together this. Wait a second. If this is a pattern, have you ever seen a pattern of one? Like, just one thing. That's not a pattern, is it? When you notice a pattern, it's because there's at least more than one, right? Or a copy. A copy of what? What am I getting a copy of? Hey, take this copy. Okay, there must be an original, right? If you say copy, I'm thinking there's at least one other. There's a real one. And that's what I'm thinking that Moses has to be thinking in his mind. There's a pattern. Okay, there's a pattern God has set in place. What is this being copied from? We get the full revealing in the New Testament. The revealing is found in the New Testament. That's why the New Testament is so important. So he says the copy, and they serve as a copy and shadow. And many people have come up front, and they use the analogy, if you can think of an alleyway, right? Somebody is walking down the alleyway, and then you start to see the shadow, right? There's backlighting, you see the shadow. You don't see the person yet. But you'd be willing to bet money there's a person that's coming after, right? I'm pretty sure there's somebody coming after. I just saw this shadow moving. And lo and behold, 2 seconds later, the person comes. That's what this was meant to be. That's what the old covenant was. It was just a shadow. It was a copy of the reality, which is found in Christ. The real is found in this new covenant. So let's actually go to Exodus. Let's go to Exodus 25. We'll take a look at this. And then we're going to look at something else kind of interesting that is a little bit of a type as well. In Exodus 25, let's take a look at starting verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall raise my contribution." Huh, sounds like God loves a cheerful giver, right? This is contribution which you are to raise from them. Gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, scarlet material, fine linen, goat hair, ram skins, dyed red, porpoise skins, acacia wood, oil for lighting, spices for anointing oil and for fragrant incense, onyx stones, setting stones for the ephod and for the breastpiece. Let them construct a sanctuary for me. He wants his tabernacle built, that I may dwell among them. What does God want? What has God always wanted? He's wanted to dwell. He wants to dwell in you, really. He wants to dwell in the Christian. According to all that I'm going to show you as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furniture, just so you shall construct it. God had this plan a specific way. And this is the verse that the writer of Hebrews quotes.
I heard Luke use this example, and then I've experienced it as well in the school. You know, so we'll, like our math sheets, you know, we'll take the original, and then we'll scan it into the computer, and then we'll print it. So the print is a copy of the original. But see, you always got to put that one, and you got to mark master, you know, do not use. Because what would happen is the kids would use that one, so then the ones that we had were copies of the scanned one that was scanned from the original, but it was printed. Yeah. And so if you keep making copies from copies, and you do that for a couple years, pretty soon you can't see what's coming out of it because it's so blurry. You know, that's why it's so important that we continually, and look, sometimes guys have to go up front and say, "I know that you guys know this," and you know, but hey, I love it because I will never get tired of going back to the original. It doesn't matter if it's the purpose, form, structure of the church. We have always got to go back to the original, right? Let it say what it says, and then pattern the church off of that, you know. Because when you don't, that's when you end up with terms like worship service, you know, which are people following other people versus being dedicated to knowing their Bibles. Or like you brought out, calling this room a sanctuary, right? Go to the scripture and how it uses its terms and definitions. Go to the original.
Yeah, excellent point. That's how you get false doctrine. Copy of copy. All right, so let's take another look at something here. Maybe I'll pick this up next. We'll see. Let's go back to Hebrews 8, but keep your hand in Exodus 30 area. We're going to get there in a second. And then if you're on your phone, I'm sorry. But Exodus 8. Well, I said keep your spot, and I just lost mine, so. Sorry, Hebrews 8. Did I say Exodus 8? I'm all over the place. Okay, Hebrews 8. Let's read. Let's just do verse 6. Again, this is where he's been building, talking about priesthood. You guys have heard priesthood a lot. Who's heard priesthood a lot in this class? Everybody should have their hands up right now. Oh, if you don't raise your hand, then I don't know. Okay, yeah, we've heard priesthood a lot. He's going to use this. He's transitioning now, right? But now Jesus has obtained a more excellent ministry. There's interesting stuff behind excellent. We could talk about that. The word there for ministry, though, is I'm just going to give you the reference. In Luke chapter 1, when Zacharias, he was doing his priestly service, is what it's called. Luke 1, you can go take a look at it, find priestly service. The ministry word here means that. It's the same exact word. Ministry, minister, it's related to service, related to priest. You should start thinking priest. When you hear minister, think priest, minister, priest. What do priests do? They minister, right? So Jesus has obtained a more excellent ministry, which is priestly services. Okay, we got the priests. We've talked about priests a lot. By as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant. This is where the transition is happening. We understand a better ministry, right? Oh, if he's part of a better ministry, then what else is to be understood? He is a mediator of a better covenant. And this is where it's going to be interesting, especially for us who are those who are part of this new covenant. We are part of the new covenant. How many of y'all want to be under the old covenant? Raise your hand. I don't want to go back under the old covenant. I is way inferior. We are under this new covenant. He's the mediator of a new covenant. We'll talk about that a little bit. Next time, it even says better covenant, which, or you could say since, has been enacted on better promises. We'll take a look at some of that next time. So we're still in Exodus. Let's look at Exodus 32. This is just so interesting. You know, you hear the Sunday school version of this lots of times, right? When Moses goes up onto the mountain for a while, 40 days, interesting. But anyways, he goes up on the mountain for a while, right? He comes back down. What does he find the people of Israel are doing? They had an idol of a golden calf, right? They had a golden calf up, and that would be really interesting. I mean, that would be kind of crazy to be Moses and to come down and then to see that. Now, they did have lots of influence while they were in Egypt from things they probably shouldn't have been exposed to. There were lots of paganistic practices in Egypt, so they came out of that, right? But they're meant to be holy now. They're meant to be different. They're meant to be set apart from that paganistic lifestyle. And Moses comes down off the mountain, and he finds him dancing around a golden calf. Now, what happens when he finds this? What does he do? He has the tablets in his arm. And what does he do? He uses them as frisbees and tries to take out the... No. Yeah, well, he did. He smashes them, right? He gets so angry, he just smashes them. I don't know if he was throwing them at them or what, but that's kind of like, in my mind, I would at least throw it in a way to get somebody's attention, right? Like, I don't know how this played out. This is just all speculation. He obviously was mad enough to throw down the Ten Commandments. That's a pretty big deal. That the finger of God wrote on. So he was pretty mad. He was so mad. And then what did he do? He took the calf. And we're not going to get the whole story tonight. But what did he do with the calf? He melted it, right? Ground it into, you know, dust. And then made him drink water with it in it, right? He said, drink that, you know. And, lots of times we think that's where the story ends. That's where the Sunday school teachers stop. Hopefully, I have piqued your curiosity a little bit. We're going to pick up what actually happens after that next week. You have the permission to look ahead, though. You can read the Bible on your own. And you can look at it ahead, okay? And it's just interesting because we oftentimes just hear, all right, there's the golden calf. He makes him drink the water, right? Some pretty crazy stuff happens afterwards. And this is going to be really correlated between this. It's going to be exciting because we're going to talk about covenants, okay? The old covenant was called a law of sin and what? Death, right? Sin and death. And then the Spirit, the law of the Spirit, what does it bring? It brings life, right? We are under something that gives life. There's the contrast that the Scripture paints between the Old and the New Covenant is just, it's so stark. And this is where I get so confused. I know I've gone online and tried to do some studying on different things, and you know, well, what is, you know, usually if I'm trying to look up something in Hebrew or something, there will always be some kind of Jewish website where they have their spin on everything about how it's, you know, this is Jewish because of this and this means that, and it's always so interesting. I always get so confused why so many people are trying to go back to an old, inferior system. And then the new covenant people, Paul and all these people are saying, dude, that all that ever did was bring death. You guys want to go back to that, you're going to reap death from the flesh. He said, you want to reap life? The new covenant's where it's at. And so, yeah, this Exodus, we didn't really have time to go into that, but this is going to be really exciting. We're going to start talking about covenant next week, and then towards the end of chapter 8, for those who really care, we're actually going to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem as well. So you might, hopefully there'll be some interesting things in that as well that'll be helpful for us. And yeah, this is a great part in the book of Hebrews. So thanks, guys.